have reports and presentations. And if you don't have an agenda, we won't be approving that or the minutes. We don't support any conflicts today on the agenda. So we'll skip that piece and go to the Executive Director's report, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, a couple of handouts for you in your packets. One was, two of them are courtesy of DNR. One is a card, about a third of the page card. That's a CPL flyer that they have just for your information. You've probably seen it before, but you got a chance to look at it again. I think they renewed it. And also, DNR's conservation agenda, their 10-year strategic plan is in your packets. So you can look at that at your leisure, nice bedtime reading, or morning coffee reading or something. Regarding outcomes, because I mentioned last agenda, we really haven't, previously, last meeting at least, we talked about staff was looking at outcomes and how do we define or quantify those. Since that January meeting, we haven't advanced that really any further, other than Joe was able to take some time and speak with Member Blackburn about her firm's experience in the area, and her thoughts and experiences as well. So hopefully we'll have a little more insight for that by March, and we'll be able to possibly bring that up for discussion on the agenda. Public outreach, just for your information, a few things have happened in the last month. On the 13th of January, the McKnight Foundation held a grants workshop for outdoor heritage grants. And,
excuse me, Christopher.
Pardon, Jane? Go ahead. Jane, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I'm just letting you know that if people could keep their paper ruffling away from their microphones, it drowns out the speaker.
Okay.
There's a lot of paper noise, but I have your mark.
All right. Thanks. At any rate, that workshop went quite well. They had a full attendance of 60, and I know that there have been some, we haven't gotten any responses yet from it with regards to full applications, but I think that definitely CPL and the others have, and I think it'll fill the pipeline down the road a ways. On the 14th of January, I was in Fergus Falls to present to the Game and Fish Club for their annual meeting. And then the next day, I met with the West Central Initiative Foundation in Fergus Falls. They are very interested, and they're going to, they say, host another workshop in the future here in the Fergus Falls area. So it's good the word is getting out. And that was what our meeting was about, was they were wondering how do we host it and so on. On the 15th of January, Joe went to the round table, and I think four or five members also went to the round table, so maybe we'll have some comments on that after a little while. There's an agenda from the round table in your packets. On February 2nd, the President's letter to the there was a letter to the President of the Minnesota Association of Counties, which I penned, and it was inviting the counties to become involved in the CPL and OHF process for asking for funds. They're going to forward that on to their members, so again, just outreach. And then tomorrow, Joe and I will be attending the Department of Ag Pollinator Summit. I asked if members of the council could come to that as well, but they said they were very restricted, limited rooms, restricted attendance. So, unfortunately, that wasn't available for you all. Regarding revenues, 97.8.056, Subdivision 8, we have been looking at it as staff, but really haven't been able to get any further since last meeting, so we're hoping to move ahead with that a little bit and hopefully come again back for discussion in March on the agenda. We'll see if that if it gets to that point. I believe it will. The another handout in your packet is the My Bills, which is on the legislative website. There's basically it just lists half a dozen bills so far in the House that are either do affect things that this council does or may affect things this council does. And I'm sure there'll be other bills also, but these are ones that were pre-filed by the House. And there are short descriptives of them, but you can take a look at those. If you'd like to go on the My Bills website, there's the site is at the bottom, also the username and password for the council members to use. So if you'd like to dig into those further. We'll try to keep that updated too with any other bills that we are aware of that come forward that are seen pertinent to this council. Marsh Lake, remember the last meeting? The Chairman Anderson had a letter that was in your packets. I think he was sending a letter to the Assistant Deputy of the Corps of Engineers and asking that the Marsh Lake be funded in full because the previous funding hadn't made it on the President's or with the President's bill. And congratulations to all because we just got a press release that says that funding was funded in full to the point of $7.6 million. So thanks to everybody also for being involved in that. And if you did contact your legislators, again, thanks for any efforts you put in. And lastly, the thing I had was just the roundtable again. pardon me. I'm wondering if there's any feedback. Julie, I know you attended the roundtable. I'm not sure who else was here, if it was David or Representative Lilly, but do you have any comments or thoughts that came back from that?
Well, I thought it was a great event, and I went to a little bit of the groundwater, but mostly to the wildlife track, and learned a lot about the moose reintroduction in the Northeast, as well as really what we're doing about putting together a deer management plan, and was very interested in the what I felt was the most well-attended and controversial topic of lead shot. So it was good. I thought that one of the keynote folks, and I can't remember his name right now, wasn't sure how familiar he was with what's happening in Minnesota because he kept talking about the need for dedicated funding and how the conservation community isn't well funded and so that just seemed a little odd to me. But overall, I think it was just a really great event.
If I can add to that one thing, the council members and those of you on the phone, you received, I think an email went out from the office that gave a link to the NRS site with some videos from that roundtable and so on. If you haven't had a chance, they're pretty interesting to look at. And that's all I have, Mr. Chair. Is there any questions?
Questions for Executive Director? Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Member Blackburn. Call on Member Hartwell to give us an update on CPL.
Sure. as per your request, I did meet with staff to get an update and talk about some of the questions that the council had with regard to the CPL process. The interesting thing is that the concern that had been expressed about was there enough interest in the metro area and was there too much money is no longer a valid concern. They just had their most recent grant round, and what I hear from that, as well as what I heard several weeks ago in general, is we just don't have enough money. There is demand outstripping supply. I think of CPL as simply one of the programs that we do, and nobody has enough money, but they don't have enough money to meet the demand that they're seeing. So that was just sort of an overall comment. And that goes for the expedited process, which is a small grants program, the under $25,000, which is now much more competitive than it's been in the past. Metro and outstate, which is good news. There's demand. In terms of specific issues that you asked me to investigate, the difference between the expedited process and the regular CPL process is basically seven questions. And there's a sense that if you don't ask more questions, you won't get enough information to give you a valid decision. And so, to me, the definition of expedited is interesting. Sort of a small grants program. where you're asking all the same questions, the same criteria. You've just reduced the questions and the amount available. I think there's an interesting discussion we can have and probably should have when we look at a request in the next round of how do we want that expedited program to really work? What's the value of it? And a discussion between the council and the program managers about what's the best way for them to be allocating money. Is expedited really a great thing, or is it not that big a deal? I just think it's a discussion that would be worthy of having based on there really not being any significant differences. I was asked to sort of take a look at inherent difficulties in the process. I heard about two. The interesting one is that the DNR has put a cap on personnel costs at 7.5% of the grant. And that seems reasonable to me. Unfortunately, it's 7.5% can be salaries or personnel costs, but we haven't put any limit on contract costs. So what we're forcing everyone to do is go out and hire contractors rather than do the work themselves, where I suspect the intent has always been to keep administrative costs low. We're actually probably forcing folks to use higher-cost contractors and doing some of the work themselves by virtue of having that 7.5% cap on personnel costs. The other issue, which has been more of an issue, I think, for the metro area, but an issue everywhere, is that the DNR has had a requirement for any project to allow hunting, not following the constitutional requirement of unless prohibited by law. And so you get a metro project where the municipality doesn't allow hunting, you can't use the CPL process. They are taking a look at that and questioning whether or not that makes any sense or whether they should be consistent with the council's requirements under the constitutional language. And I think they'd love feedback from us on that particular issue. The personnel costs
off. Can I butt in here?
Sure, you can.
Could we talk about that now, or do you want to wait until you're done, David?
Whatever you'd like to do, Jane, is fine with me.
Well, I mean, my sense, if I'm hearing you correctly, is the Constitution isn't being applied uniformly between, the programs and projects that we fund versus the CPL program, and I don't know how we can justify that.
It's an interesting question. You know, the constitutional language that we look at projects under is that hunting and fishing or taking of game must be allowed on any fee acquisition unless prohibited by law, and the DNR, for whatever reasons in the past, has had a policy of must require the taking of game, or however it's worded, and just dropped the unless prohibited by law. I think they're questioning that now, as you and I would probably agree they should. You know, I guess the question is, how does the whole council feel about that?
I mean, you know, personal feelings aside, being a hunter and fisher, of course, you know, my general preference is always to have public access, but we have to, you know, go forget our and forego our personal bias, and it has to do what is constitutional. And I don't see why CPL would be excluded from that. In either metro, outstate, or small, you know, the small, small executive.
Executive Director Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, just to add a little more information on this, I did talk to DNR about that. And my understanding, I hope I get this right, but DNR, the standard that they've applied previously has been based on statutory law. So when it says unless otherwise provided by law, it hasn't been with regards to municipality law or, you know, regulation rules or anything less than statutory. So if it doesn't say in statute or that there's another reason, for instance, let's say I'll make up a scenario. Let's say the city of Grand Rapids doesn't allow deer hunting within a certain range of the city limits, and yet they have a CPL project or whatever, a CPL application in. Because it wouldn't be allowable to hunt in under statutory law, and previously it wouldn't be allowed, it wouldn't be eligible for a CPL grant. That's what they're reviewing right now. Should that be a broader interpretation? That's what they'd like our
feedback. Yeah, I mean, we have talked about that in the past, and you know, I think there was a lot of discussion and a decision based on advice that we got with the Arboretum project that the municipality doesn't allow hunting. How can we force the taking of game in an area that isn't allowed for that, even though it's a great habitat project? It was a, you know, an undeveloped lake adjacent to the Arboretum. So, I mean, they're reviewing it. We've already had guidance that that's a that municipal restrictions are valid, prohibited by law, and the DNR has taken a different view, but now they're reviewing that. So I don't know what members want to do with that, but that's going on right now in terms of in the DNR's deliberations on this.
Well, I think maybe we have to hear from the DNR what they're proposing, and then have it on the agenda for the next meeting.
That's fine.
The Grant looked like he was ready to come down.
I was thinking the chair was going to invite me down.
I would be happy to invite you down if the chair would allow us.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
Good morning. For the record, Grant Wilson, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Chair, just to, I guess, echo what's already been said, we're certainly looking at considering changing this this requirement that we've been doing. Essentially, what we've done in the past is taken the constitutional requirement, and for the program that we've used, have looked at it more narrowly. One of the reasons is that the programs that came forward, and there were that many, would not be very competitive in the scoring criteria. But we think that it would be probably appropriate to consider at least broadening the eligibility to match up with the council's eligibility. So I just would welcome any comments you have. Certainly you can give them to me or to Mr. Hartwell or to Mr. Johnson or other staff. But we're happy to continue this conversation with you. And we certainly would have until the next council meeting to make any decisions.
I guess the one question I would have then, how does that place you statutorily? You said,
So,
Mr. Hartwell said that there was an issue on the statute.
Mr. Chair, the Constitution requires that that lands acquired in fee must be open to taking a public taking unless otherwise provided by law. Our requirement has been that they must be open to taking of fishing game unless otherwise provided by state law. So you could still apply if there was a state law that prohibited hunting or something like that, but it didn't apply to municipal code.
And the effect of that is essentially the metro area becomes very difficult to do projects in, or any metro area, not just the Twin Cities, but St. Cloud or Rochester or Duluth, where they have projects but they don't allow hunting within the city limits, for example. But they're still habitat projects.
Correct. And this change, making it consistent with the council's requirements, would make those projects eligible for consideration.
Thank you for clarifying.
Good questions for Grant? Thank you.
Other things that I heard was there was a question about feedback from applicants, what was good and bad in the process, and the, I'll call it somewhat humorous, response was that it's easier to get a CPL grant than to come to us. We create more scrutiny and it's a more competitive environment, and so applicants would like to see the limits raised so that they can have access to funds. You asked, I'm telling you what the feedback was. Most of the projects that CPL funds ultimately are sort of DNR and Fish and Wildlife backed projects. There aren't many that are sort of the local group that's going to do projects on their own land or purchase land for their own purposes and not transfer it to Fish and Wildlife or DNR. And that was kind of what I learned. Were there questions, or did I answer the questions that you all had?
Very good.
If you have more, let me know, and I'll continue to prod gently.
Thank you.
Very helpful. Thank you. Thank you, Member Hartwell. We'll move to the item on the agenda. That's the report on the land acquisition. And Joe Pavelko will give us an update there. Everyone's read that, I'm sure. Cover to cover.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Before you have the land acquisition report. We actually just put this together last night. Just kidding, it took quite a while. All the data inside the report was reported to us as completed as of June 30th, 2015. And that's an important thing to remember as you're looking through. So as projects are reported completed within our system, that's what we reported on. So, an appropriation recipient was working on a project, and maybe they did complete it before that date, but they hadn't actually gone into our system and called it completed, it would not be included in the report. So there was a certain cutoff, and we had to just say, by this date, these types of projects, this is what the report's going to include, because it's a continuous reporting system, so every day new stuff is coming online, and so that would throw off our numbers as we're doing this. So this is everything that was completed or reported completed as of June 30th, 2015. So what we'll do is we'll just go through all the tables, starting on page 3. And if you look on page 3, this table talks about fee title lands acquired without built life obligations or liabilities. So this is Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife lands, any lands that are held by the county or different counties, any municipalities, or any nonprofits that are holding them in fee that where they're paying taxes, such as TNC. So that's what makes up this table. You look at the end. Actually, let's go to the map. There's two maps here, or four maps, two pages, both sides. Different colors on them. If you look at the one that says fee title land acquisition acres without tilt obligation, you can see that so far as of June 30th, 2015, 16,926 acres were acquired. You can see the distribution on the map with the different color scales. So blue being the least amount of acres and red being the most. The highest amount of land was bought in Clay County, 2,642 acres. That's mostly done by TNC and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. If you move to the next table, fee title lands acquired with PILT obligations. So this is all DNR lands. And this does include, so a nonprofit acquires property and then donates it to the DNR, that is included. So I want to also make sure that it's just not DNR acquiring these. This is also nonprofits acquiring for the DNR. If you look on that map, which is on the other side of that map we just looked at, Dr. Heritage Fund fee title land acquisition acres with PILT obligation is acquired 25,390 acres as of June 30, 2015. And you can see the distribution is a little bit more. There's more counties covered there. Acquisition has occurred in 62 counties with PILT obligations, and without PILT obligations, 36 counties. And I think part of that reason is that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they're focused more within the prairie transition areas, and they're focused more on wetlands, and it seems like that's what's driving that difference. Whereas DNR might be buying lakeshore and northeast, or they're just more scattered throughout the state. They have different programs, too. I would also like to point out a couple outliers. So Cass County fee with PILT, the average per acre price was $31,237. And I think that's mostly because they're acquiring lakeshore properties. And so obviously the value per acre is going to be much higher there. In Carver County, the fee without PILT, there was the Arboretum property, and that was $55,000 an acre. And so that's why there's a major outlier there. It's not that we're looking to spend that kind of money, but if you that property, we only have one property, and that's what it's worth, that's what you get. Same with Washington County, probably a potential for development on those properties, and that's why it's $29,000 an acre. The average size of fee title with PILT was 131 acres per transaction, and the average size of fee title without PILT was 135 acres per transaction. So interesting that those were still pretty similar in size. Again, all lands are divided by the public land survey of 40 acres, 80 acres, 160, and 320, 640, and I think that's a result of that. If we go to total fee title lands acquired with and without PILT, this is just to show the total, everything that's been acquired in fee. And the reason we have it separated is because our online system a while back, I don't know if it was required in the very first few years of OHF, but when you report on acquisition, you report with fee or with PILT obligation without, just to show that difference, and that will be important when we go towards the end of the report when we have to try and calculate future PILT obligations. And so we have to have what lands actually will have PILT obligation and which lands won't. And so that's why that is important. So if you look at the total, as of June 30th, 2015, 42,316 acres have been acquired. And, since that date, I'm sure there's been a lot more acquired. And you can see the distribution there. So there's only a few counties where fee title acquisition hasn't actually occurred. Not that many. And we would envision that eventually, over 25 years, that fee title lands will be acquired in all counties.
Joe?
Yep.
Ron, did you have a comment?
No, okay. I don't.
I thought I heard you trying to jump in there. Sorry, go ahead, Joe.
All right. If you look at Table D, this is fee title acquisition, sellers for parcels reported as completed as of June 30th. So these are the types of sellers that agreed to sell if the to either the DNR or Fish and Wildlife or whoever the recipient was as OHF. And as you can see, 84% were acquired from private individual, so that when we say private, we're talking about, you know, the Smith family farm, or, you know, the Pavelko estate, or, you know, just, you know, two individuals, not a private corporation. And we put that distinction in there. So 9.4% of all fee title acquisitions were acquired from private corporations. 4.7% of the fee title were acquired from nonprofits, and that's a, and that's, again, that's not, you know, Pheasants Forever receiving an appropriation and then buying a property and donating it to the DNR. This is the nonprofit used other money or had this already in hand, and then OHF was used to buy it. So the OHF did not cause the, that to happen. So. And then only 4% or 1.25% of four transactions were from government entities. So you can see the breakdown there. Easement lands acquired. This was pretty interesting. I thought there was going to be many more actual easement transactions, but the reason it, there isn't is because the Forest for the Future, the big legacy Landon project, kind of throws off or skews the numbers. So in total, only 276 easements have been completed, or, you know, 276 transactions, but the total acres was 226,000 acres. So, and most of that was actually from because of the Blandon property. And so if you look on the right, in the very bottom right, it says average payment per acre, and overall easements were $353 an acre. When, if we take out the Blandon property, because it skews everything, the average easement cost per acre was $2,089. So, for 19,011 acres. So it's interesting how that, without the Blandon, it gets a better, you get a better representation of what we're actually paying for the smaller easements. And the average size easement with Forest for the Future was 820 acres, but that's obviously not the case. And so take that out, and the average size is actually 71 acres per transaction. So again, seems to be pretty close with that, you know, 80 acre range. If we go to Table F, the percentage of fee title land acquired within each county as of June 30th, and the estimated fee title acquisition over the life of the Outdoor Heritage Fund. So I think what people were wondering is how much of the land within each county is actually being acquired with OHF. And as you can see, you know, in the fourth column from the left, the percent of county acquired as of June 30th, fee title, everything is almost below, you know, even half of 1%. So it's a very low number as a percent of the entire county acreage. And so if you look on the very bottom of this table on page 15, the total land area in Minnesota is 51,218,000 acres, and to date we've acquired 42,316 acres of that, or 0.083% of all the land area. And if we wanted to estimate what the total amount, how many acres we would acquire, as the report directed us, or the Minnesota law directed us to do, based on our most recent three-year average, we'd acquire 266,000 acres. And based on a lifetime of OHF, we'd acquire 275,000 acres. So this is about where we should be, or where it was estimated in the 25-year plan. The 25-year plan had estimated, I believe, somewhere between 660,000 acres and 1.5 million acres, and that's both fee title and easement. And when you add this number up, these estimates up with our estimated easement acres, we're going to be right in that 700,000 to 800,000 range, and so we're going to be probably on the low end of what we thought the 25-year plan was estimating it to be. And I believe that was done in 2011. So it's kind of nice to go back and, you know, just compare what we thought back then to the actual real numbers that we have now. Table G, this is the same thing for fee title ends, only it's for easements. And again, of course, for the future skewed the results. So what we did when we estimated the lifetime easement acquisition, we removed those acres in the calculation but included them in the total because they've already happened. So using our three-year average, we're estimating 426,000 acres. Using the lifetime average, 441,000 acres for the easement. So you add those two up, easement and fee title acquisition, and that's your permanent conservation footprint that OHS will have on the 45. If we go to Table H, sum of property taxes for previous 5 years prior to acquisition. So this this was getting at whether or not PILT was covering the actual tax costs or property tax costs. And the way that the law required us to report this, this is how we had to do it. And a couple issues we ran into here. Many of the properties didn't actually have tax data. And when we say, what we mean by that is that when a property has a unique parcel ID number, and the counties use those parcel ID numbers to track them and, you know, obviously use those to calculate taxes. And if you acquire, let's say the parcel ID is 101 and that's 40 acres, and the OHF recipient goes in and buys 20 acres of that 40, well, now after you've acquired that 20 acres, now there's two parcel ID numbers, or there's a new one. And so you can't go back and compare those taxes. You'd have to do some sort of calculation, and it would be very difficult to do, because if you're buying, if the 20 acres that you buy is the least valuable of the 40, then, you know, trying to get an average on those 20 acres would skew the tax results. So what we did is we actually only gathered data, tax data, for the properties that actually had were the actual parcel ID that was existing and what they bought. So the 40 acres was what was acquired. You know, the 101 parcel ID number didn't change, and then you can track back your previous history to get that tax information. So when you look at that, we only had with fee title acquisitions without PILT obligations, we only had 98 parcels, or not parcels, but transactions that had tax data. And there could be, within each transaction, there could be multiple parcel IDs. So if you're looking at 1,000 acres, there could be 20 different parcel IDs within that. So then when you went to, when we would go back, and we actually requested this information from the project managers, that they had to go through and get each parcel ID number for each transaction, and then, you know, go back 5 years. So there's a, there was a lot of data, and this is the thing that took us the most amount of time by far to get, is because, you know, we don't actually get this data or require this data to be recorded to us in our system. And so there's just a lot of work to try and get it. And then when we did get it, you know, we found out that, you know, maybe half or so only had the data that we were looking for. So when you look at Table H, just know that that's, I guess, more of a representation of what we were required to do. And I'm not sure exactly what the value in it would, what you can get out of it, except for that, you know, it shows some tax liability, I guess. But it's, again, it's hard to compare this to, you know, taxes. So what we tried to do then is in Table I, is estimated tax obligation prior to fee title acquisition. So what we did was, is we used all the information that we had, got a tax liability number, which was the single year prior to fee title acquisition. So the property was closed in 2010. We used the 2009, the single year 2009 taxes. And then after we calculated that and got a total for the acres that we had tax data for, then we got an average and then used that average to calculate the for the acre, the tax liability for the acres for the data that we didn't have. And then that hopefully would give us close estimates of the total tax liability for all of those properties. So that was our effort to try and get something meaningful out of it. And I think we did. So as you can see, fee title acquisitions with PILT for all the properties, the 25,000 acres, we calculated it to be $614 or $614,677, and that's the 1 year prior. It's the 1 year prior to fee title acquisition. So that does not include any increase in property taxes or decrease in property taxes. This is just, you know, there's all the millions of assumptions that we can make, and this is just one way of looking at it. I did want to say, though, if we added 5% to that 614, that would be $645,000. And if we had a 10% increase across the board for all of those properties, it would be $676,000 total tax liability. So what does that mean? Well, if we look on Table J, actual reported completed fee title acquisitions with PILT. So this was trying to estimate the total PILT liability for all lands that were acquired in fee that have PILT obligations. So again, this does not include properties that go to the Fish and Wildlife Service, properties that are held by NGOs, or any properties that are held by cities or counties. This is only DNR. We are estimated that as of June 30th, 2015, properties that were reported completed, that there's a PILT obligation of $795,187. So, and then on the very right-hand side of that table, we just did a simple average PILT cost per acre just to see what that number would look like, because it seemed to be pretty interesting. And as you can see, the $795,000, we wanted just to see, you know, what, compare it to the 614, or, you know, what the actual tax liability would have been, or what we tried to get. And you can see it was, you know, $614,000 to $795,000. So they're close. Our calculation is PILT is a little bit more than the taxes, but again, there's lots of different things going on, and I don't know if there's a real easy way to calculate that. So that was our attempt to do it. Table K on page 23. This is estimated future PILT obligation. So obviously we have properties that we've acquired to date, and those have PILT obligations, and that's a cumulative responsibility to the state. So every year, 2009, you buy property, in 2010, from here to whenever, you have that as a PILT obligation. So as you add on, the PILT obligation becomes cumulative and gets higher and higher as years go on. And so, but we only reported on what we required, and so if we want to figure out what our total PILT obligation will be at the end of these 25 years, we had to do another calculation. And in order to do that, we had to estimate how many acres we will acquire, or that the DNR will acquire, take in, that have PILT obligations. And based on the recent three-year average, it's 108,000 acres. Based on the all-year average of the lifetime of OHF so far, it's 122,000 additional acres. And so if we use that number to calculate this, I would say part of PILT, one of the issues, it's kind of a confusing formula, but to date, OHF recipients have paid 8.4% less than what the appraised value is. And the way DNR calculates PILT, they take either the higher of the appraised or the purchase price. And so to date, we've acquired, on average, 8.4% less, or paid less than the appraised value. And so we actually had to calculate or get the appraised value, because that's the higher of the two numbers, to get a better idea of what the PILT obligation would be. And so we use the fifth column from the left. And on the total appraised value, what we're saying is that at the end of 25 years, we will have paid $523 million, or appraised $523 million of property, which TILT would be calculated on. And if you add, if you estimate that number, we get $3.928 million plus what we've already have in the hopper. When we add those two together, we get a total estimated annual TILT obligation of $5.221 million at our recent 3-year average and $5.127 million on our all-year average. So at the end of 25 years, we're estimating that TILT obligations for OHF-funded properties will be $5.2 to $5.1 million. And interesting thing about this is that TILT is not so much a function of the number of acres, but it's more on the value of the property and the appraisal. So if you have, if you're buying small acreage at high price, you're still going to have the same amount of TILT as if you had many acres at the same price.
Member Harbaugh.
So, Joe, thank you for this and what you had to go through to get. But I'm confused. On page 21, there was a total tax estimate on an annual basis of $614,000 for TILT.
Yep.
And that's through today's acquisitions, in essence, more or less. But then when you go to
which table is that, please? I don't have the same page.
Table I. And then if I go to table K on page 23, you're talking about an annual obligation of $5 million. I'm not sure I understand how we get from 614 to $5 million.
Mm-hmm.
Can you help me understand that?
Sure. So the 614 is a number that we estimated that was if it was in private ownership, and
yeah,
this is what we estimate that would have gone,
sure,
as property tax. Okay? So then when we go to calculate TILT, TILT is based off the 0.75% of the appraised value or the paid price, whatever is higher. And so that, it automatically goes up already because we've seen that it's, you know, to date, we've hit, the TILT obligation is $795,000.
Yep, that's the number I should have been using, not the
6%. Yeah, so. And then we had to somehow figure out, we had to estimate, you know, so we've got a set of data from 2009 to 2015. And the problem is that, you know, those appropriations go for multiple years. So just because it's, let's say, 2012 money, people are still working on it, reporting on it. And so we had to come up with a calculation to try and estimate all of the acres that we could acquire and then use the numbers that we have in hand to, you know, influence the calculation. And so that's how we came up with the total TILT obligation.
So what you're telling me is, just to be sure that I understand, that we're likely to do 7 times as much acquisition in the next, until the end of the funding, the 25 years, as we've done today, for 6 times. If I take the $55,100,000 and I divide that by 795, you're roughly 6. So you're going to do 6 times more acquisitions to get you to that 5 million.
Possibly, but again, TILT is based on the value and not the acres. So if you look on the very left side of that table, what we're estimating is that on average, we're either going to acquire 5,735 acres a year or 6,517 acres a year. So I don't know if that calculates to be 6 times more or not, but
it just strikes me as total obligation to date being 800,000 and you're estimating an obligation of 5.1. It seems like we got a lot more acquisition to do than we've done, 6 times more. In rough math, whether the math is perfect, 5 times, 6 times, whatever, you know, but we're quite a ways into the overall cycle. It doesn't make sense to me. I'm just trying to understand that, because it's like, I'm confused by that particular number.
Yeah, we can look into it and see if there's something that we...
You see why I'm confused?
Yeah.
At least? Okay.
Yeah.
That's all I'm asking.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
I have a couple questions when it's appropriate.
Do you have further...
I just want to add
one table further, I think.
I want to add something to that question, too, is that... I believe, over the life of OHF, the total estimated tilt obligation was somewhere between $4 and $5 million. And so, we're right above that. But again, it's a function of the value of the land. So.
Do you want to cover that last table and then go to questions here?
Right. And then, so the last table shows the total amount of land that's been acquired by the state of Minnesota. And this data was actually obtained by MMB. They actually have a state land inventory report that all the agencies are required to report into them, and then they report out. And so that data was obtained from the MMB reports over the years. And so the data that we had was the 10-year span that the law required us to gather was the best we could do was 2004 to 2014. And as you can see, over that time, the state acquired 73,142 acres. And again, most of it coming from the natural resources. So we haven't done too much analysis with that, but it would be interesting to maybe do a little bit more to see how that compares with how OHF influenced that. And that's the report.
Great, thank you. Very good. Member Kingston, you have some questions.
Yes, thank you. First question is, do these tables and all the calculations include the CPL program?
Yes, if CPL reported them to us in the system, then they were included. But I don't know the percent of how many of CPL acquisitions have been reported to date, but I know that CPL acquisitions were in there.
Okay. And then my second question is just one bit of information that's provided on Kennebec County. It doesn't match with the online LSOHC OHF map. That percentage being like a high point in terms of percentage of property in the whole county. The county is
you're breaking up, Jane. We're not getting.
Okay. Kennebec County, the percentage of acreage looks high, and it doesn't match the map on our OHF website. We have two projects, according to our OHF map, Ann Lake at 48 acres, and Kennebec prescribed fire management with 392 acres. So I'm questioning that percentage on Kennebec County.
Mr. Chair and Janet, I believe that's a function of the reporting. And if something, this was acquisitions that were reported within our online system and not necessarily the map online. And so the way that works is every so often after we get reports, then I think it's twice a year the map is updated with that information. So it could be a function of when the timing of reporting and when things are reported, whether or not what's reported in our system is then updated into the map.
Okay, so I won't use the OHF map as gospel. I'll use the land report as being more timely.
That is correct. That is this.
But even with that, does anybody else remember what big projects we've had in Kennebec County?
Mr. Chair and Jane, the two big projects that I can think of were the sharp-tailed grouse. That partnership acquired two larger tracts. And I believe that was for over 2,000 acres.
Okay, further questions for Joe? Do you have further questions, Member Kingston?
Not at this time, thank you.
Senator Ingerman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Joe, I just apologize for being late here, but on page 24, you have State of Minnesota fee title ownership for the years of 2012 to 14. So that's only through 04 to 14 acquisitions by the designated agencies, like the State Fair has 359 acres, State Public Safety 34, Pollution Control 2,618. These are just the acres through this cycle that are purchased and owned?
Yes. Those numbers are what are reported to MMB through their report.
Joe, if I might
land add, inventory report.
If I might add, clarify me if I'm wrong, but those are actually, as of 2014, report to MMB, the total acres owned by those entities, correct?
Yeah, fee title.
Yeah, not the ones that they purchased during those times, but the aggregate of what they own.
So, you know, an agency could have acquired 80 acres and sold 80 acres and, you know, be at zero. So it's we tried to request that from the agencies. We wanted to know, you know, what you have acquired over 10 years and then split that out, what you acquired and what you sold and what you divested. And we couldn't get it. We just couldn't get it. So this was our best option to provide that data. And we thought that, you know, because these were something that's been going on every 2 years for the last number of years, that would be a useful data set to use.
Okay. Thanks. Representative Voting.
Thank you. The report's really fascinating. It's clearly something that's been talked about a lot at the legislature with the PILC. And it's, I realize it's a flash in time, and it's, you know, some projects are in the middle, so it's, you know, it's kind of been tough work, but it's really interesting to see it. I like to see the history of all the land, too, of that's owned by the state, so that's an interesting thing. It seems like the PILC is kind of in line of what we, I think early on projected, would kind of be, doesn't seem like it's totally out of the realm of expectation, I think, going into this thing. I don't know exactly the numbers, but it just seems like it's more reasonable than I thought. It does kind of stand out, you know, that I was surprised to hear that that it does include the CPL and that they're isn't really much going on in the metro, so that's pretty clear. So I think there's a future. I'm glad that that Mr. Hartwell was bringing up some of that earlier. That, you know, I think we need as a goal to try to broaden our map. And the metro isn't the only counties. There's some other counties that look like they're left out as well. So and maybe they're covered in other ways. But I was wondering if you could speak to that 8.5% under market value. To me, I thought that was really a highlight, that 8.4% rather below appraised value, that you're able to purchase land. And I think that's kind of a hats off to this group. I mean, something to be proud of, that you're able to acquire land at below market rate. And I'm just, if there's more comments about that, I'd be curious, but I thought that was pretty impressive.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, one thing that I would add is that that 8.4%, that is based off of what was actually paid to the landowner. So that is not actual OHF money paid to the landowner. So there, in many, many instances, the recipient of the OHF money may be using federal funds or private funds in addition to OHF. So the OHF, you know, the total outlay for all of these acres is a lot less than that because they're using matching funds to buy it.
Senator,
thank you, Mr. Chair and Joe. So, and again, I probably missed this coming in, but what is the total state obligation of PILT? Do we know? And the other question I have is, going back to the same chart I was on the ownership property by agency here, you have the University of Minnesota on one line, and then you have state colleges and universities on another line. I see some of the information is unavailable, but that should be added up to be an accurate acreage to all of the universities in the state that are state-owned, including MinSCU. So that's one question. The other question is, what is the total state obligation for PILT? Do you know? I know there was a number bantered around when I first came here of $20, $21, $22 million. And as Representative Lilly said, you also said, I think your data shows that we're about, at the end of the day, we're going to be adding about $5 million to that total state obligation. I think that's kind of right on track of what we've always been talking about. But do you know what the total PILT obligation is?
For Mr. Senator Ingebrigts, so is the question for OHF funded properties, or is it for
just overall?
Overall, that I don't.
You don't know that.
And then to answer your question on the table L on the back, so this is, we use all of the agencies that reported into that land inventory report. So if they. I looked into state colleges and universities versus the University of Minnesota, and they are two separate entities, is the way I understand it. So that's why they're different.
And there's no PILT obligation there?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Thanks.
Further questions for Bill? Maybe you can help me as I try to stumble through this question, because I'm not sure that I know enough to ask the correct one, and that's with regard to the Blandon acquisition and now the reduced value that I think the court has upheld that, of the value of that land, and so there's less taxes being paid. Does that mean that the PILT increased or did not increase in that instance? And maybe the answer isn't out there yet.
Because it's an, or Mr. Chair and members, because it's an easement there, it's not, it doesn't have any PILT obligation.
So there's a loss of tax revenue to the counties.
There could be, and I don't know.
So that would not be made up under PILT then.
Right. That PILT is only paid by the state of Minnesota for lands that they own.
They have acquired.
That's in fee.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, and members, just as I understand from that lawsuit, and I'm not a legal scholar, I'm just trying to interpret what I heard, was that, or trying to relay what I heard, and that was that the difference in tax revenue was based on the way the county was, or counties were valuing that land on parcels rather than fees, or rather than whole. So a separate issue and different from anything we're dealing with here on PILT. A county tax issue versus, in the courts versus anything we're dealing with.
But the counties, because of the, is it because of the lease that has been placed on it, or is it the way that the counties were assessing?
I think, and I'm not 100% sure, but
the question was whether or not to value it as a large parcel or a whole bunch of individual parcels.
But did the lease have an effect on that?
Not the lease, the conservation easement. And the easement basically said it was always going to be one large parcel. But we're in a nuance that's this nuance.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I'll get the I'll make sure that we get that summary finding from the court to you and the members.
That'd be helpful. Further questions? Did you have something to add?
I think Mr. Chair, that David covered the comment. Basically, because the easement requires that it not be subdivided, that it be maintained as one block, that I think the court kind of used that to determine that it had to be treated as one block rather than the individual parcel, because they can't be sold off individually. So it would be the market for one very large parcel, which would be different than a bunch of individual parcels. That's my recollection of what the determination was. Basically, what David stated.
Okay, good. Thank you. Further questions then? Comments?
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, just for the record, I'd really like to release some thank yous on this report. Joe had already mentioned some of this, but I'll reiterate. First of all the project managers, many of whom are here. I would like to thank you for your excellent and very welcome help. So again, thank you all. And to the agency staff for their additional help and understanding through this whole exercise. It was quite an endeavor. To the county treasurers, we probably don't have any of them here, but county treasurer and auditor staff who worked patiently with our staff in helping us to find the individual parcel tax information. That was a big chore, and we really appreciated that. And lastly, but definitely not least, to NDHA staff, to Jackie, who's not here. She was an intern or a part-timer with us at the time. But to Amanda and Sandy and Joel for all the hard work they put into this, compiling and analyzing and calling individual treasurers, fund treasurers for tax information, and working with agency staff and project managers. So a special thank you to you. Did I say NDHA? I'm sorry. That's... What a poopa. Okay, to the LSORC staff, my staff, thank you very much.
Well, certainly much deserves that thanks and great work by just a lot of folks and certainly SARCSAN's council staff. That was a very, very good report. Very well done. Thank you, Joel. With Ron, are you still with us?
I am.
Thank you. With Senator Ingebrigtsen's arrival, we now have a quorum, and I would officially call the SARCSAN's Outdoor Heritage Council meeting for February the 11th to order, and I would ask a approval of the agenda.
So moved.
Motion by Member Hartwell. Discussion on the agenda or the motion. All those in favor of approving the agenda as presented, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Excuse me?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that if you have people in by phone, that every vote has to be a roll call vote.
Oh, right. But I'm sorry. Thanks for clearing that up. So we have to have a roll call vote on the agenda. Amanda, are you prepared for that?
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Ms. Blackford, yes. Mr. Hartwell,
yes.
Senator Ingebrigtsen,
yes.
Ms. Kingston,
yes.
Representative Lilly,
yes.
Mr. Sheriff,
yes.
And Mr. King,
yes.
That's seven.
Okay, we have unanimous approval of the agenda. Thank you. And that motion carries. And so we have the agenda before us then. And we will move to item two, and that's the minutes of the January 5th meeting. And with pleasure with January 7th, excuse me. And with pleasure with those minutes.
I
I'm happy to move approval.
Motion by Member Hartwell to approve the minutes of the January 7 meeting as presented. The discussion on the motion or the minutes. That will have a roll call.
Ms. Blackburn?
Yes.
Mr. Hartwell?
Yes.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yes.
Ms. Kingston?
Yes.
Representative Lilly?
Yes.
Mr. Sheriff?
Yes.
And Chair Anderson?
Yes.
And that's 7, please.
Okay, we have approval of that motion to approve the minutes, and motion carries. Thank you. We'll go to the item 3. Is there any conflict of interest on today's agenda? Okay, we'll pass that. And we've had the executive director's report. Also, item 5 and item 6 have been processed. So we will move to item 7, and Matt Rivers and Jamie Markle.
Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, if I may.
Please, Director.
Mr. Chair, members, at the last meeting in January, the council had discussed DNR's ability to track the OHF properties that were purchased, as well as management tracks on those properties. So that's why the DNR has been asked to come in and finally are going to provide us with some overview of their prioritization process of lands, as well as the management systems and so on. Thank you. Mr. Rivers and Mr. Martin.
Good morning. Thanks for having us in to talk today. Director, my name is Pat Rivers. I'm Acting Deputy Director of the Division of Fish and Wildlife from Minnesota DNR.
Mr. Chair, Council Member Jamie Markle, Assistant Regional Wildlife Manager for DNR Wildlife and Center.
So we were asked to come in to talk today about how we prioritize land acquisition and also how we manage those lands. Today I'll talk about the Division of Fish and Wildlife, specifically the wildlife management areas, and to a certain extent aquatic management areas. But certainly the Division of Forestry and Ecological and Water Resources, when they acquire parcels for state forests, scientific natural areas, and Native Prairie Bank, have similar robust processes to ensure we acquire the highest priority lands. DNR acquires lands for WMA and AMA across the state, primarily for public hunting and fishing, and for production of game and fish species. At any given time, our area managers have many opportunities, probably hundreds of opportunities, to acquire land from willing sellers. Our goal is to ensure that we have a current priority list of parcels that are available for sale based on each Lusard Sandbuck and Heritage Planning section. These opportunities have already been filtered once. We have many opportunities where landowners come in and ask the area manager if he or she is willing to, is interested in their land. And we say no a lot. So this first cut, getting into our database at the area level, is already kind of step one in prioritization. Once a parcel is kind of deemed that an area manager has interest in that parcel for those wildlife management areas, we have them establish a scoring system or a scoring tool. This is a GIS-based score that considers the shape of the acquisition, how many acres, and where it is in the landscape. Things like native prairie, if the parcel has native prairie, if it's a deer wintering area, addition to an existing unit, or how much existing protection is in the area, and a number of other things that we feel are important for acquisition. This is scored in an objective fashion based on that planning section, so you wouldn't expect a northern forest parcel to have native prairie. Conversely, we wouldn't punish a prairie parcel for not having high conservation forest. Once we have that score, and twice a year, we have our regions gather those area priorities and develop a regional list. Last week down in New Ulm, our regional manager and staff gathered with areas to come up with a regional list. This is a very team approach to this. It's not simply send in your priorities and we'll shuffle and make sure everybody gets up their top priority rank, but rather a comprehensive deliberation about what are the highest priorities given what's available at that time. Those priority lists are sent to St. Paul, where we further look at them in terms of the funding opportunities that we have. So, for example, the last couple funding cycles through the Lusard Sandbuck Heritage Council, we have chosen to fund only work in the prairie. So we'll take a look at all of our current priorities and submit those for funding. In addition to our regional managers meeting twice a year, we meet with our conservation partners also when we're developing proposals and when we're completing our accomplishment plans in the fall. We do this to make sure that our priorities are met, and if we don't have enough funding for them, we can see if a partner has funding for them, and also to see what they have for opportunities for acquisition. So we meet two times a year, and then we also have bi-monthly conference calls to talk about how acquisitions are going and any new opportunities that might be in the landscape. But we don't want to let prioritization and the process of that kind of come at the expense of a good acquisition. So if we find something in between times, maybe it has high conservation value or native prairie, or it's in a prairie core area, we'll ask to add that to an existing list if it is indeed a higher priority than we currently have.
Mr. Chair, council members, the Section of Wildlife is responsible for over 1,440 wildlife management areas. This represents about 1.3 million acres of habitat and public lands. Management in this property base is spread out over four regions, each of which is divided into a number of administrative work areas and major units. Projects on these properties are diverse as, you know, the routine boundary management, sign maintenance on the properties, to prairie and grassland restoration projects, to multi-phase and complex wetland and restoration enhancement projects. Across all of this work, all of our projects have two key things in common. They have a location, so they have geography and data. They have a location on the landscape or in a specific place, and they generate a lot of information that needs to be managed. So as project management has evolved at DNR, so has the need for tools to manage this information, such things as inventory, tracking, prioritization, and reporting. Our field staff that have been around for a while can recount this evolution fondly. They remember the paper forms and fax machines that we used to send them around for signature. The shelf lined with map books and pre-ring binders, and then the advent of email and all the electronic attachments, approvals, and project ranking in that fashion, all the spreadsheets and databases, all good tools, but all separate. And then more recently, the improvements of geographic information system, desktop software that our managers have used, it became clear that there was a need for an enterprise information system that pulled all these pieces together to improve the way we manage our lands and we do our work. As early as the mid-1990s, the wildlife section of the DNR was pioneering in the field of geographic information systems and GIS with full-time dedicated staff, developing tools at first that would focus on making the area wildlife managers' jobs easier to track the lands that they manage and the work that they were doing. It became apparent that a statewide system would also help with project prioritization and planning and help at that statewide and program level as well. In 2011, the section went forward with an LCCMR proposal to build such a system, and that project was funded in 2012 for 3 years. So in 2015, that came to fruition, and we now have a robust system developed and built that offers and puts in the hands of managers a really sophisticated tool to manage the workflows, everything from proposing projects to completing them, and then eventually we're going to be improving project components of a system that will help with reporting. So today I'm here to introduce you to the Wildlife and Aquatic Habitat Management application. It's kind of a mouthful, so we use the acronym WAMA for short, the WAMA system. I'd like to refer you to the handout today and the key elements in the project focus. These are the business needs DNR had going into this, if you will, and they're also the key points that kept this project in focus along the way, both developing the scope and what's in and what's out, and then also keeping it on track as we developed it and as it was built out along the way. So looking at that, we had a need to maintain an inventory of the characteristics and conditions of all of our WMAs, AMAs, shallow lakes, and wildlife lakes, and then to be able to propose and review, prioritize and track projects across these lands and waters, projects that, you know, are set up to protect, restore, and enhance habitat and clean water. We had a need to record accomplishments and produce reports, and then also management guidance documents specific to an individual WMA or major unit that guides our management over time as managers and staff change, just to kind of keep our eyes on what the priorities are and the focus should be. And perhaps most importantly, create the ability to estimate our deferred obligations. That's a conversation that comes up frequently at DNR. I know it's come up here as well. That ability to be able to look systematically, programmatically across this data. What are the things we're funding, but what are those things we're not getting to? What are the things we need to be doing that maybe we need an initiative for, a standalone proposal, a bonding request, or just keep it at the front, forefront of our conversations and what needs to get done in the short-term, mid-range, and long-term. So with that, if you flip your handout over, there's a slide that breaks out the three main components of this WAMA system. I'd like to start off by talking about the work planning portion of that. And that, you know, there's always been a groundswell of ideas from our area wildlife managers. A lot of our best project ideas and priorities come from the bottom up. They're being filtered out from area wildlife staff and wildlife biologists that are working on the landscape. In the past, these project proposals were reviewed, evaluated, and ranked using paper forms or fillable Word documents and then spreadsheets to kind of keep track of the most important projects and details about them. The problem with spreadsheets in the system, it works, it's very labor intensive, and every time somebody makes ranks or comments, it's a static spreadsheet or something that's saved and then passed around by email, and it's really hard to have one comprehensive system for storage and decision making. So this new WAMA WP system is an online interactive tool that allows field staff to submit projects and develop them, and then managers at all levels within the agency to review those projects, whether they're individual projects, subsets, and lists focused on a particular habitat type, all within a live system that has customizable filters. So you log in to a dashboard, you can search projects that are proposed or reviewed by a fiscal year, by habitat type, is it a project, wetland, is it a facility maintenance project, those kind of things. So it's really intuitive, easy to use, almost requires no training. When you get into an individual project to look at it, it has a tab interface, so it allows the manager or whoever's reviewing it to get that key information quickly. Proposers and reviewers can leave comments in the system, creating a dialogue on the project and funding cycle, and thereby improving communications immediately. It has a review tab that lets an area manager add priority or rank to their subset of 8 or 10 projects they're putting in for a funding cycle. It allows me at the regional level to look at those priorities in terms of the landscape we're looking at. It, you know, what are our highest priorities at the region and how they fit in with our programs. And then finally at central office, how do they fit in with our new realignment with habitat-specific and habitat-focused funding and project work. And then with these projects, there's a mechanism that we can look at their status. Have they recently submitted, reviewed, have they been approved and funded? Have they been completed, dropped, or put on hold for whatever reason? The funding tab is important. It allows us to look at what was proposed as an amount, and then what was actually funded. Did the project get full funding? And perhaps most importantly, what was that funding source? Was it a particular OHF appropriation? Was it dedicated funds like our pheasant or turkey or deer habitat management accounts? Another nice feature of this proposal system is the ability to store attachments. So all those things that were on people's hard drives or on share drives, now they can be tied specifically to a project in that whole body of work. So things like plans and specifications, burn plans, permits, photos about the project, correspondence can all be stored on system-wide, and they're available to anybody that's interested in that project. In addition, this WAMA work planning app, it becomes an archive of projects and priorities that can be evaluated from year to year, thereby establishing, it's a working database over time that you can look at project needs, accomplishments, and deferred obligations. So that's the first piece, a real process improvement over the way things were done previously. It went live in 2013, so we have a few years of projects in there now, and you can already start to look at the amount of work and that's gone into it and the amount of communication and just documentation that's there. This year for the FY16 funding cycle, we have almost 500 projects across the full region. So quite a bit of work. Obviously not going to be able to fund all of that, but it's also there to be used moving forward. Shifting gears a little bit to the mobile side of this application, this is the field-based portion. This is probably the most exciting piece, and it's really geared towards inventory. It relies on tablet computers. We did a lot of research and testing on different products available. What we ended up going with was the Panasonic TalkPad. It's a ruggedized tablet that you can protect even more by putting in a case. It comes with a stylus where you can use it with your finger as well. We purchased 40 right off the bat, enough to put one of the hands on each work area in the state. This year we have plans to purchase an additional 40 to 50, the idea being there'll be two per work area for the manager and assistant, or to give to the technician when they head out. It's a convenient way to capture data in the field. It's one point of entry rather than multiple. You're not making a note, going out to the office, adding it to your GIS, adding it to a database. You capture it in the field and it's there. It's live. I can view it in St. Paul in the regional office. It has a map interface, which is easy and intuitive navigation and data capture. You zoom in the map by pinching and pulling, searching by a place name, and then when you narrow down to an individual facility, the land cover layer, you simply click on it, and it opens up some worksheets to add information about it. You also have the ability to not only edit what's in there, but create. So you can create points, lines, and polygons, just like in GIS, with an easy interface. And you can also use the device itself to have a GPS-enabled feature where you can walk a line and record it. You can walk the perimeter of a field and record that, or you can do a single point, like you're at a gate that needs to be repaired, capture that point right there and keep the notes. So really improving the way we do business, our hope is that one point of data entry, and hopefully over time it kind of replaces the field notebook, the sticky notes on the dashboard of a truck. Our managers love it so far. It's one of the things that really established some buy-in with this cutting-edge technology for us, and we're really excited about it. Moving on to that third component, which is the desktop app. This is built on the same platform, so everything's synonymous. Data captured with the tablets is available immediately in the office. It's a little bit more robust in terms of the way you can navigate the system, what we can do with it. Searching tools, you can use township range and section, latitude, longitude, and a place name to get down to a specific area you're interested in. Turning layers on and off as needed, things like aerial photo imagery, DNR base map, public waters and lands covers. In many cases, this desktop application replaces the more complicated ArcMap software that takes a long time to load, requires specific training. You can take college-level courses on GIS. In this case, we have a user product we've developed that's easy to go in for any spatial inquiry about a WMA. Any WMA information, you double-click the icon, it's immediately open and very usable. The desktop app, we also added the idea of unit-specific information, so we call it habitat management unit data in the system. This is information we want available to the public. Information that used to be provided on the north-south maps, those big paper fold-out maps that had all the WMA location information, what species can be found, where, what recreation opportunities exist, and where you can access it. Now those things can be managed by the Area Wildlife Manager in the system, the desktop application. And when they approve it in the system, it will eventually feed live directly to the public-facing website. So you can find information about specific WMAs in a county, where you can park to access those, what kind of species can be found, are there specific regulations, special features, any visitor information specific to that site. So another way that we're linking information that we're building over time with inventory directly to our public website and already incorporating the things that existed. Some examples would be a water control structure inventory and condition assessment. Things that already existed as separate databases were incorporated into WMA, so they're there to use. And we just hope to build on it moving forward from year to year, and that body of information there from projects to geographic information to project information is just going to grow over time. In closing, I'd like to refer you to the last slide. It's on the back page of your handout here. This is the status update for each one of these components out of December. And as I mentioned, the work planning portion of it is 100% complete, functional, and we're using it. The geographic components, mobile and desktop, are 100% complete. We have the container built and the system built, and right now we're able to do an inventory for facilities and land cover, fully operational. The next step, a few bars below, is going to be the activity section of that GIS, and that's the work that gets done. You go out and do a prescribed burn. You do a drawdown on a shallow lake. You go out and do some mowing or some fire breaks. Those things are eventually all going to be captured in this system, and in turn, we'll be able to produce accomplishment reports on that information, and also look at how we're accomplishing our objectives over time. We've talked about those, you know, the management guidance documents for a specific year. The public web products, that portion is under testing right now. And for those of you familiar with our WMA information page on the public website, that's going to be changing quietly behind the scenes here, but in a powerful way that I already mentioned. We have the ability at the area wellness manager level to change and update that information, keep it fresh, and keep it current and accurate, versus those old paper maps that were printed and out of date as soon as they went to press. And then the last piece, which is under design right now, is the reporting piece. And it's hard to have the reporting in place until all the individual components are populated and functional. It's also related to the project management piece, which is tying geography, accomplishments, and financial expenditures together. And that's what's important for our outdoor heritage funding reports, our game fish fund accomplishment reports, federal aid. All those reporting requirements that we have in the section are going to be addressed in the project management piece that is the next priority for this project. And in closing, I mentioned that we were successful in getting a game and fish fund initiative for fiscal year 16 and 17 to hire an additional dedicated developer for this project, and also some additional hardware, tablet, computer, CDM. So we're really excited about it moving forward, and be happy to take any questions.
Okay, questions for Pat and Jamie? Senator Ingres.
Thank you. Pat, maybe the first question would be, when you talk about lands and managing practices, so can you give me or the council an idea about what's going on in the area of the DNR swapping land? Is there a lot of that going on? Do you take care of that? Are you part of that process?
Senator, we have a program called Strategic Land Asset Management, and we're constantly looking for ways to improve. I think the commissioner calls it to change the platform, so to speak, where we can consolidate lands where it makes sense, where we can trade with counties. So we are active in that. I am playing a small role in that, but we are doing that across the state where we can make a difference.
Not only counties, Mr. Chair, not only counties, but also private. Swapping with private. Do we do that?
On occasion, we do that, yes.
To make contiguous properties, WMAs and things like that.
Yes, we call that an exchange.
Is that a big process? Do you know how many are done a year?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't know how many are done for a year. It's not that common. We found it's actually more efficient to sell land and then to buy land instead of an exchange. That means an exchange needs to be equal value, and that can be challenging with different acreages and different characteristics of the land. So an exchange, said another way, is a sale and acquisition. In terms of fish and wildlife, I would say we do maybe five per year at the upper end.
And there's somebody specifically in your department that handles that?
Our Division of Lands and Minerals runs the kind of the behind-the-scenes acquisition and kind of the legal aspects of those documents. But it would be, you know, say a landowner has a proposed exchange. He or she would talk to an area manager, see if that exchange makes sense. We talk about it in St. Paul. How would we fund that? We can't use up to heritage funding for that. So if we think it's a good idea, we can proceed with that. If that makes sense.
If it's purchased previously by Pittman Roberts money, it cannot be exchanged. Is that do you know that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, if there are federal aid on it, we cannot exchange that land unless it no longer meets the needs for which it was acquired. If there's a trespass, I believe those are the two main criteria when we can kind of extinguish the federal aid. If it makes sense for us to do an exchange, we can discuss with the Fish and Wildlife Service why it's a benefit to the resource to do an exchange. But really getting rid of a federal aid component on land is difficult.
And the other question, Mr. Chair, I have about the program of WAMA. Technology is something that just absolutely, like you, I think you said it, when you get these maps printed, they're updated as soon as they hit the desk. Is this program, does it have the ability to be utilized by all departments of the DNR, like the COs for, I'm thinking about detecting, recording bait piles, recording illegal activities such as leaving deer stands and things like that at WMAs. I mean, how immediate is that and recordable? And going to be used in a court of law? Is it not quite that far yet?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's a great question. And this application is available to other divisions within the DNR. We just recently in December had a presentation to all the other divisions. There is a video recording of that presentation available on the DNR's website. The Enforcement Division already has a fairly robust tablet computer data management system. I forget the acronym for that one. But they use it for everything from managing their fleet and time to mileage expenses and then all the work they do and documenting that. That also includes a geographic component. But yes, Enforcement will be able to utilize this app. It's available for Android devices, which they use as well. So it's available just on the normal app stores that you go to. And then we would provide on request the access information, like a username and password for the application. So it will be available to enforcement officers, and there is some interest there, especially for reporting point information and referencing spatial location.
Member Hartwell.
I'm curious, we get requests in here for give us money to help buy us land, to buy land that we'll transfer to DNR WMA programs from all over the state and all different kinds of groups. And it's very confusing to us to know what's truly a priority. And so we have to use, I guess I'd say, judgment without information. But it seems like the DNR's got to have something they could share with us in terms of what's really their priority in a region or however you define it, an ecotype, so that we know when people are coming in here that they're doing the highest priority projects versus just projects that are in their backyard that they fall in love with. And I can fall in love with any parcel of land, so I get it. But, you know, we don't have the dollars to do everything we'd love to do. Can you give us any help on how we can make better decisions with more information when we see requests coming in?
Mr. Chair, I think the first thing is our SWOT tool and the criteria that we use to measure our parcels ourselves as an objective measure of how does this rank. That's one criteria. In addition to that, you know, what does that parcel mean to a given area office? I mean, the SWOT score can be low on a new tract, but if it's a large enough piece and it provides great habitat protection or other opportunities, that SWOT score can be a little deceiving. So I think there's context that area managers can provide at times that would be helpful in addition to that SWOT score. We do approve all of those acquisitions that your partners are seeking funding for donation to the state. But certainly we could share the SWOT information and how we've refined that over the last several years to give you what we feel are our highest priority attributes per planning section.
Good. I mean, I heard you sort of say SWOT score is a great thing, but so, you know, I'm thinking we could request that people only do projects that are SWOT score blank and above. But I just heard the big but. It keeps us from wanting to use a score that you have as an absolute. Give me a little think about how, I don't need an answer today, but it'd be really helpful to know that we're really doing the work that needs to be done versus work that people want to do. And I don't want to make it sound like people aren't doing work that's important, but I want to know that we're providing funding or recommendations for funding to do the stuff that's most important. Somehow, I would think anybody here is going to want to do that. We've just been stymied in figuring out how to do that, and so we look at the reputation of the groups and what we know about the area personally, and we really have no definitive information about how projects are being prioritized in an overall scale. And I just struggle with it and always have, and I want to make recommendations that get the best project done. And somehow I feel like you guys can help us do that, since most of the projects we do end up being DNR projects.
Member Blackburn.
Thank you so much for the information you provided today, and I'm excited for you guys and this technology application you have. I'm sure that will make management and reporting much easier. And I have two different comments about that I'd like to make. One of them is just thinking about kind of more the, if there's any public applications, and realizing the things that are coming up next with AIS, and you know, the whole reporting of citizens maybe through applications such as this of aquatic invasive species or other things like that. Just, you know, if there's anything like that that might be going on. But I guess more for me, the more important thing is this whole prioritization. And I love GIS and the application of that, the analysis of pulling together all those different data in order to map out, you know, and provide a really great context prioritization. But with every, there's objectivity, right? And then there's selection of criteria, which maybe isn't quite so objective. And there's also setting which thresholds for ranking are you going to prioritize. And so I would love to have more information about, in those different areas, what are those specific data layers that you're looking at, and how are you prioritizing different data with each other? And I realize that's a much longer conversation, but I'd like to know, like in the prairie area, how much is it about proximity to other land or endangered species or habitat potential, or there's just very different ways that you can break your thresholds to cause ranking to go higher or lower.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Blackburn, we'd be happy to provide you with the criteria that we've developed and the rationale behind it. And it has evolved over time, and we certainly have managers across the state who would advocate for their resource, so to speak. But as a collective, we've come up with what we feel are good priorities for the section block. And certainly, it is subjective as you decide what the criteria are, but then when you apply it, it becomes an objective base.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just do a follow-up, thank you. And then that whole thing about you get all that data, and kind of to David's question about the but, okay, but there's opportunistic things, and I'd be curious as to how the DNR goes about addressing those and what kind of decision-making process there is, and maybe there's something that we can learn from it here, because we certainly have criteria, but then sometimes there's some, you know, additional circumstances that maybe make one project prioritized over the other, even though maybe they have the same habitat potential. And so I'm just wondering what you guys do internally for process.
Mr. Chair, I like to think of it as an and, not a but.
Okay.
On both swaths for it, I might have really good information. For example, if it's we do value adding to existing structure or existing protection. So if it's a new unit but it has native prairie, that's going to go to the top of our list because it's a rare habitat type. Similar fashion, if it's a small park but it controls the outlet of a shallow lake, that might not score well, but it affects a much larger area than that small footprint of that parcel. So those are just two examples where a SWAT score might not be the only part of the story. What we do is we really rely heavily on regional managers and Jamie and regional staff who work with areas to come up with what they feel are the most important priorities. As they send that to St. Paul and we work on funding this, we rely on that. We might in St. Paul choose to go down the list and pick that native prairie because we know it's a higher priority for our commissioner than it might be on a given parcel. And it also relates to funding. If we're not going to buy anything in the forest with a given appropriation, it doesn't matter if it's number one because it's going to wait for a different funding opportunity. I hope that helps.
Yeah, that's helpful. And that's part of the thing, too, is also just, and I'm sure you guys battle with this, and I think it's the same for us, as far as maybe what has the highest scoring versus you know, as far as overall habitat versus maybe those individual priorities, and sometimes maybe the priorities aren't the ones that are selected because of, you know, those other factors. And so I just wonder sometimes, it's just more of a, you know, kind of a, I don't know, mind wandering thought of really how do those things actually line up in the end, you know, from basically that evaluation of all those criteria to what actually gets funded. And it's the same thing that we, why we're going over all of our ranking criteria. So all those things that rank higher, are they necessarily the ones that get funded or not? And it's not exactly one of those things that I think has a specific answer.
Mr. Chair, may I add on to Patrick's response? Mr. Chair, council member, we do, in addition to the objective criteria that are part of the SWOT scoring process, which is, you know, it's a buffering exercise. Where is the parcel located? Where does it sit on the landscape? How does it intersect, or what's its proximity to all these other layers, like ecological classification systems, priority forest types, those kind of things? We have subjective things that go along with it as well. You mentioned one, it's an opportunity for a large acreage tract, for a key tract, for a larger project. We also have one, what is the threat of imminent development? So I like to think about what happens, you know, if this parcel doesn't rank high, doesn't get approval at the region or the section to move forward, what's going to happen to it if we don't buy it? Is it going to still be there, you know, providing wildlife habitat, or is it going to be subdivisions, that kind of thing? And then another one is, does it resolve a management issue? Is there a parcel that would simplify a boundary, provide better access, reduce trespass, otherwise consolidate ownership between WMA and State Forest Tract, as an example? So there are things that are kind of like checkboxes, subjective, things we consider along the way as we prioritize and rank that aren't necessarily part of that objective score.
Mr. Chair, one last thing about that. It doesn't matter what kind of priority it is to us if we can't get to yes with the landowner. So that's another filter that we have to consider in terms of pursuing that position.
Member Hartwell.
So if you were up and you're trying to allocate money, what would you be doing to ensure that this council is allocating money to projects that are really the highest priority versus just doing work? I mean, what guidance can you give us about how to rank programs? Should we establish that your project has to meet an average SWOT score or above unless you can explain why it doesn't, kind of a strategy? Or what would you do so that we can feel more comfortable that we're really making wise recommendations? What guidance can you give us?
So, Chair, member, I think I need some time to think about that, but I think looking at the land acquisition report and looking at the past performance of what our conservation partners have done, there aren't many that I would point to that are kind of a missed opportunity. I think we've done a pretty good job. You know, how can we, you know, bump it up to the next level of greatness in terms of getting priorities? I'd have to think about that some. Certainly, if you want to look at it in terms of what we consider our priorities, but that doesn't necessarily make it our conservation partner's immediate priority. But maybe that's a larger discussion we can have.
I personally would welcome your feedback and thoughts on that, because it, you know, you just said the key word. It may be our partner's priority, but it may not be the state's priority. And I'm interested in how this becomes good decisions with state money for state resources overall, not because someone is enthusiastic about a project. And I've been very enthusiastic about a lot of projects in my life, so I get that, and I don't want to diminish that, but I'd rather have the enthusiasm about projects that make a bigger difference than those that are just projects. And so if you can give us any insight, it would be welcomed by me at least.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lilly first, then Member Kingston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really excited about this. You know, I think on our last tour when we were out in Wilmer and we're kind of looking out over the land, just how complicated it was where they were describing different entities that were responsible for different parcels. So we would be able to look at your maps, you're saying, and see who's in charge of each parcel and what their projects are and how it's all tied together. That's, and then I have others.
Mr. Chair, Council Member, that's true. The layers that we have within the system that we'll be continuing to expand on have not only DNR wildlife administrative areas, but also park areas, other state entities as well. So yeah, but when you zoom into a particular landscape, like you're standing on the prairie out by Lac des Parles, you'd be able to have that tablet in your hand, zoom into that specific area, look at the surrounding landscape. You're going to see parcels that are color-coded by entity and responsibility. And then also from your desktop computer as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really find that exciting for us as policymakers, I think, too, and decision makers, that it's got to make our life easier as we look at these different projects. I think of our last meeting where we looked at that, was it Grand Marais or, you know, the creek, and they had all those pictures. So sometimes I wonder if we could somehow add like a drone component to this. I mean that's probably the next step, I would think, is where you can
want
to
follow the skunk,
right? To follow and then to see the before and after, and then as we assess it, you know, after the impacts. And I think about you know, we've talked again about the Northwoods project, and you know, we had a chance to walk on that land, but it would have been neat to see, again, with like a drone, too, where you could see where those trails and how they actually worked. We never got really into so much of that land, and you could see so much more. So that's probably the next step down the road, is even adding a lot more visual. I always hope that some of our proposers in the future consider adding that to their proposals of you know, projects that they're want us to pursue, because I think that would make it easier for me to kind of visualize what we're actually talking about. You know, this land is, again, Northwoods, but they said like that one part could be like a trout stream. Well, we never really got back in there to see what that would or is right now. But if we were to have like an aerial, you could actually see what it is and then what it might be. So, anyways, thank you for your work. I'm excited. Again, thanks. I think LCCMR had a hand in this too, so, and I'm glad to see that as well. So,
thank you, Member Kingston. Questions or comments?
Thank you. You know, it's sort of vindicating or validating to hear that DNR recognizes that their SWOT concept addresses the objective, for want of a better word. But that then they add a lot of subjective input as well, such as from the managers out in those particular areas. That's one thing, and that's what we are struggling with in terms of getting our criteria relevant and valuable. Secondly, you know, if you look at building on existing protected land, if the existing protective land is not does not hit our regional priorities and goals,
we lost you, Member Kingston.
I agree with that last line.
Mm-hmm. What was that?
The last word we had was goals.
Okay, so this is so hard to participate. I'm really sorry I can't be there in person. Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
What I was saying about, you know, if we're looking at adding land to existing protected land, if the existing protected site isn't ranking high up on our regional priorities and goals that we have, then just adding land to land that isn't high on our regional priorities isn't necessarily a good acquisition or a highly valued acquisition. And all of this trouble that we have in compiling data that's objective and subjective and how to get it on a criteria basis is really the big, big challenge of all of this. And, you know, so far we're analyzing everything based on acres and dollars, but if we can't get to some better way to define, you know, the value or the benefit, then we're not really getting where we need to get. But it really does line up with what we're trying to do in our criteria discussion and our call discussion, and I hope that DNR can stick around for that.
Very good. Thank you. Other questions or comments? I guess maybe, I'm not sure if I can add anything to the conversation, but the project parcelization may not always be totally in sync with the habitat priority or the conservation value. But whatever priorities that the DNR has as a kind of 10,000 foot level, looking at the whole state. So, but there is there really any poor parcelization projects?
Mr. Chair, I went to the Region 4 meeting last year. I didn't get to it, which was just this past week when we had multiple snowstorms. But I went last year, and there were, I believe, 40 different parcels we looked at, and I put a pretty critical eye on all of them, and to be honest, I didn't see one that wasn't a good project. I think our staff are doing a really good job of weeding out projects we shouldn't pursue at the front end, and then we are left with very good projects. And Jamie just sat through Region 3's prioritization, and I can go into bed. It's a difficult process to determine, is this our top 10 or is this bottom 10? Because it's hard to tell.
Very good. Thank you. Other questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you. It's been very helpful, and we look forward to more information from you.
So...
I know we're the new building.
Move to item 8 on the agenda, and welcome Dr. Keaton Gladowich from the Minnesota Aquatic Species Research Center. Thank you for being here.
Chairman of the Council, I'm delighted to be here. Yeah, I'm Susan Gladowich, Professor and Graduate Research Center Director at the University. I'm happy today to provide you an update of our progress in establishing the state's Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center. It was established in 2012 and received 3 appropriations from the NRTF and 1 from the Water Fund for $12.5 million, providing us support until 2019 to really launch an ambitious set of initiatives to respond to the AIS threats in Minnesota. My aim today is to give you a sense of how we're doing, the challenges we face, and to give you ample time for questions. Why is research important? Right now, most responses to AIS around the world, even in Minnesota, are not successful. In some cases, it's because available prevention and control approaches are not used effectively, but more often it's because science-based solutions do not yield to this. So basically, we need more tools to address AIS in Minnesota. So why a university research center? Basically, it's because we offer scientific rigors, an independent source of information. We have the capacity to do complex research, and it also affords us an opportunity to train the new generation of professionals. And all of these things, all of these notions of why a university research center actually came from our stakeholders during our strategic planning process. So what is our mission? Also from our strategic planning process recently completed, to develop a research-based solutions that can reduce the impacts of aquatic invasive species in Minnesota by preventing spread, controlling populations, and managing ecosystems, and to advance the knowledge to inspire action by others. And so it's a broad, basically a broad scope research center aimed at all various sort of aspects of AIS response. Here's the challenge we face. It's easy to imagine developing a research program for whatever AIS species you're most concerned about. You can imagine us sort of throwing all our resources at that thing that threatens the lake that you perhaps are most linked to. But the fact is that we have approximately 40 species that we consider high priority species, either because they're here and spreading, because they're here localized and are likely to spread, and we know that they'll have impacts based on what goes on in other states, or we believe their arrival is imminent. And so that means we have 40 species that are things that, in all reasonableness, we, you know, could and should be working on. But that would spread us awfully thin, and so we do need to make some choices. The other issue, too, is that some of our research needs, some of the logical things we should work on, are really not species-specific, but systems-based. So we know that by understanding particular pathways or particular sort of agency processes or how ecosystems respond, we can actually come up with efficient sort of approaches that affect multiple species. And so, basically, we also want to be looking at systems-based research, whether it's economics, ecosystems, common pathways, or whatnot. So, to give you an idea, then, when we begin to launch research on a particular species or set of species, what does that mean? What are the challenges associated with that? In some cases, particularly fish, as you'll hear from Peter Sorensen next, we've had that capacity for quite some time to do. We needed to expand it, but certainly that's part of what we brought to the table in 2012. As Peter identified, though, in 2012, we lacked some fundamental expertise in particular areas, and one of those was zebra mussels. So when we received the funding in 2012, basically we had to begin by hiring faculty members and also staff. We also had no lab facilities to do that research, and so we needed to renovate facilities, both laboratory and holding facilities, and also then launch research in multiple arenas, detection research, pathways, and control. And we need to do that in partnership with people who are doing sort of on-the-ground work, for instance, at Christmas Lake and working closely with the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District. So that gives you a glimpse of what it means to sort of launch research and why it's been really a very busy and challenging few years for us. Here's another example. If we're thinking about aquatic invasive species plants, we have about 10 species we can choose from here. We have about two individuals that are focusing on this. First of all, we need to figure out what species should be the priorities. And in the same way that we needed to do for zebra mussels, we first needed to add to our investigator capacity. We needed to hire another faculty member. Dan Larkin started in September, and that brings us up to about two people who focus on this and lead teams. We also needed to develop laboratory facilities and also plant growth facilities, and then scope the research and choose amongst established species, arriving species, and some new and emerging issues like Eurasian water milfoil hybrids, and then begin to launch the programs. So, for instance, Dan is launching research on starry stonewort, which is a species of concern, as well as addressing some of the species that have been here for a little longer. So where is our capacity right now? Where is the center's research team capacity? We have about 4.5, and we have a half of PI here. That means they work on more than one kind of organismal group. So we've got 4.5 investigators, so 4 teams that are fully sort of occupied working on fish, 2 teams working on plants, 1 team working on AIS invertebrates, and 1 team that works on harmful microbes. And then a variety of staff that build capacity within each of those teams. So if you can imagine, for instance, for invertebrates, that's great for giving us a good start on zebra mussels, but then we also need to build capacity to have people working on things like spiny waterfowl as well. And so we'll be basically developing our partnerships and networks with other researchers around the state to help us sort of fill out that agenda. What are a few examples of our current work? We're assessing Asian carp swimming abilities in order to optimize gate operations of Mississippi River locks and dams to better deter those fish. And that's Peter's project, and I suspect he'll tell you more about that shortly. We're also determining what level of doses of herbicides, Enthavol in particular, are effective for treating curly leaf pondweed while also being safe for native aquatic plants. And that's really key for us to not just come up with solutions that are able to kill things, but we also need to be able to do it without damaging the resource. And so that's a key part of what we're interested in and working on. We also have work going on predicting the spread and impact of emerging diseases like Heterospirus on game fish in order to target their prevention. I think that's probably an underappreciated sort of arena of invasive species is are things like pathogens. And then we're also sequencing the genome of zebra mussels, and we expect to use that information to understand the most important pathways of spread and then hopefully also develop new control technologies as well. This is a summary of the projects that that we've committed to and are working on in the last 4 years. You'll see things like VHS screening, which is already completed, but most of them are in progress, including working on zebra mussel pathways, a variety of fish projects on Asian carp, common carp, several carp projects on milfoil, and so on. We also have a set that are now launching because of our sort of new capacity in AIS plants, as well as projects that we'll be working on collaboratively with USGS and La Crosse on zebra mussel control and with University of Minnesota Duluth on water fleas. Also notable, too, is our AIS detectors and trackers program, which will allow us to really capitalize on citizen science capacity in the state and, I think, be a good sort of link to the public in our research program. It's important to realize, though, that research in and of itself will not really result in a solution that is implemented and is used. For us to have to be able to go from research to an actual response that's happening on the ground, we need to have strong partnerships and be interacting with local agencies, with state and federal agencies, with landowners during our research projects, but especially when we are embarking on a solution that we need to test and see if it's going to be, you know, suitable out there in the resource. And so that's one thing the center takes very seriously is our connections to the agencies and to other organizations that will be critical for implementation of our research solutions. And in that sort of networking issue, and a little bit more on thinking about how we engage with the public to advance research, one of the things that we will be embarking on in the coming year is an AIS data management network. And we were meeting with DNR about this yesterday. The issue is basically when DNR gives a permit to take particular action on the ground, they require a certain amount of before and after monitoring. Can we up the quality of that monitoring so it's more reliable, and yet, you know, still reasonable to perform, and is consistently done around the state so that we can actually pull all that together in a data network, have that be supplied by the organizations that have those permits, and then the role of the center is to analyze that information, find patterns of treatment effectiveness, and then with that information, basically share those findings with stakeholders around the state, making bold treatment recommendations and identifying major uncertainties that will give us sort of strategic ideas on where to put our research resources. And we expect this to be initially most important in dealing with AIS plants as well as with zebra mussel control activities. Over the long term, how will we know if the research center is making a difference? It's sometimes hard to know that in the world of AIS. You know, the best news is no news, right? And we don't want more species coming into the state. So to some extent, if our prevention research and prevention deployment and responses in the state are effective, then we won't really, it's not easy to necessarily chronicle that good news. But we do think there will be a few things that should be evident to know whether it's making a difference. First of all, do AIS managers have access to more science-based information? Basically, do they have more tools at their disposal? And yesterday, in a meeting with DNR scientists, it's very frustrating, DNR managers, it's very frustrating for all of us right now to realize how few tools there are anywhere for dealing with starry stonework and trying to not be in that situation as much as we are right now. In the future will be an important difference. Secondly, are there more science-based AIS tools available for detection and control? So in addition to more information, are there more tools available? And then even with the tools we have now, but certainly with the array of approaches, do our managers have greater certainty when they select options for AIS response? Right now, there's a variety of chemicals that can be, you know, basically, so to speak, thrown in a solution. But the question is it just simply trial and error, or do we have a reason to believe that one will be more effective than another, especially in our northern climate? Basically, the bottom line is eventually we want to know, are we spending our dollars and efforts on the most effective options, implementing them in the most effective way, and with the least amount of non-target impacts? So that's what we hope to be able to demonstrate. And we've certainly been able to leverage the funds we've received, both through a variety of, well, just through a variety of groups and organizations, especially lakeshore associations, who provided important support for the research center. And so with that, I hope we have time for questions.
Absolutely. Questions or comments? Members?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, thank you for the presentation. I was one around here, one of the originals around here when we did the funding of the center in 2012, and with, oh, I suppose you'd say high expectations as compared to what was there. We were quite excited about it. Whether we're gaining headway on aquatic invasive species or not, I guess remains to be seen. I happen to be in West Central Minnesota, where it's kind of a hotbed for the zebra mussel, and we spent a reasonable amount of time talking about the flying carp situation, which to me, you know, when you get into these areas, it seems that you would have to prioritize and what would be the most dangerous to our system, and that was one of them, it seemed to me, at that time. So when you talk about collaboration, I'm wondering if sometimes we stand out here on an island by ourselves. Do you know, or can you tell me what our neighbors to the east are doing and what the federal government is doing as far as collaboration? Because we're talking about some potentially very significant damage to our, not only our ecosystem, but our financial situation here in Minnesota, when we have such a wonderful resource that potentially could be compromised. Are the federal dollars and the federal folks participating in any research with the university? And if so, can you tell me how that's working, or the other states?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Robertson, yeah, it really is very much species specific, and so the federal, sort of the multi-state collaborations, I think, to give you an example of where it's well developed, would be in the realm of Asian carp response and developing an Asian carp management plan. That's not the same as research, but certainly USGS has some research. Another example is zebra mussels, where certainly the lab in La Crosse has research ongoing on zebra mussels as well, and then will be funding some companion work to their efforts. What I think is interesting, though, is that at the federal level, many of the priorities are going to be set, or research dollars, really, at the national level, are going to be addressing national priorities. And so in that case, we're competing with other states, like, say, Florida, warmer climates, where there are different species that are important in those states than in ours. And so what remains absolutely essential is is Minnesota-based support for these Minnesota priorities. So while there are opportunities to collaborate, it is possible to get some federal funding to do research on AIS that matters in Minnesota to ensure that we actually have adequate focus on the species that matter to us. I anticipate that state-based funding will always be a really important part of that.
So, Mr. Chair, when I go back to my area, and I have a lot of lake associations, as you probably know, in that area that are involved and like to be involved, and it would seem to me that pretty soon some outcomes have to come out that we are going to be able to assure, you know, the general public that the dollars that we're spending is actually doing some good. And some will say, no, it's not. We're going back and forth between lakes, and we're spreading the zebra mussel now. This new wart is coming in, and we just aren't going to be able to do it unless we go to a police state and shut down all our accesses to the public. And that I don't think is ever going to happen. I shouldn't say never. Who knows? So so you know that at least in my area, eventually something is going to have to come from the dollars spent. Are we slowing the migration down? Possibly. Maybe the efforts that we're doing now are working. But I think the work that the research facility is doing is paramount. It's crucial. I think at the end of the day, and I don't know when that day is, but we're looking for some silver bullet that somebody can stand on the Lake Carlos Darling Bridge and throw a pill in the lake and say we no longer have zebra mussel in that lake. I don't know that that'll ever come either. I don't suspect it will. But the lakes that have had zebra mussel, I'm hearing some positive things. I'm hearing some clarity. I'm hearing some things that they're actually dropped down now in numbers, and we've got our lake cleaned up. So it's kind of, you get kind of hit from all different directions. And I'm sure you hear that as well. I don't know if there's a question in there, but I just need you to know that folks are wondering, and I know we, as there's only two of us here that carry bills and are part of the process, and if we don't do something, we're damned. If we do something, we want some outcomes, so the public is hungry for that. They really truly are, and with the staff that you have, it seems like you're quite minimal as far as, you know, getting things out there and getting things accomplished. Is that fair?
Mr. Chairman and Senators, we want a big one too. That certainly will be sort of a clear demonstration that research can deliver. Research takes time, and I think that that's not very satisfying, but I think that oftentimes the solutions that we do see coming out of the U are based in research programs that have had long histories. The next new apple variety, that's been in the works for 30 years. And so I think that one of the issues we face is sort of what I try to convey here is within 3 years, what can you do? You can build capacity, you can sort of set up the teams, you can get the research underway, and then basically we're going to have to sort of work on a number of different avenues and have enough concerted effort to be able to sort of, actually sort of push through on a solution. And so has our research resulted in reducing the spread yet? That would be very hard to, sort of link those two things together. I think that to the extent that we're reducing spread of a species like zebra mussels, you have to look at things like the prevention programs that are in place already. Certainly, I think that to note, though, how our research is going to help make those prevention programs even more effective, we have some really interesting work going on with by Nick Phelps, who's doing using sort of public health style modeling to figure out what's the likelihood that certain lakes are acting as super spreaders. What are the sort of likely connection paths, and what would we be able to say about the most important places to deploy inspections and so forth? And so that's a good coupling of using our using something in our information that they gather from voters, using our research information, pulling it together and trying to come up with ways to make our current programs more effective. And then there's some others, like the barriers that Peter will talk about, or the genome sequencing zebra mussels that hopefully within the not-too-distant future, but we'll have to be a little bit patient, there may be some approaches that offer some convincing evidence that that the research has indeed paid dividends. Until that time, though, and even after, what we do is, every day try to figure out, really how to do research that makes a difference. And in many cases, we are scrambling, on Starry Stonewort is a good example. How fast can we get a team of, say, six experts here this summer from, a variety of places where that Stonewort is, and get them sort of working together so we can accelerate research? There's not one paper on that species right now that we have to sort of go on. And so we need to assemble the experts so we aren't just basically, shooting in the dark on how to treat Lake Tormes. Right now, this trial and error is just too inefficient. There has to be a more efficient way for us to make that happen. So,
Representative Lilly and Member Blackman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. I agree with Senator Ingebrigtsen, but I happened to be over there. I see the corpse flower the other day, and I noticed that there's nothing going on with the building. So I'm just curious, are you renovating the building? I didn't see any. You had bonding money, right, to redo the building. And I'm just wondering where all these researchers are going to be, like in the in-between time once you start. I'm just trying to refresh my memory on the timing of the bonding or the renovation of the building. Aren't you going to renovate it, the old building there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we are right now commissioning the lab. The construction is virtually done, and the ribbon cutting is March 2nd. And so we will be moving into the lab, which we received $7 million in renovation funds from the state. And so we've been in temporary quarters for the winter, but within the month we will be occupying the new facility. It's exactly what we needed. Good containment, outstanding facilities, and we're really anxious to show it to all of you who've been involved in this, because I think for some of you who just stood there and, had to just wonder how are we going to do this, the transformation is really amazing. So we're delighted, and it's going to make an enormous difference to being able to sort of, do more research and have more researchers involved in this. So,
does that that must help with recruitment? Then I would imagine to have a nicer, newer facility, and then the other question would be, so I remember you had one fish tank basically doing the research for zebra mussels. So please tell me we're going to be able to move beyond one fish tank for the state of Minnesota.
Yes, definitely. And to the issue of recruiting, when we recruited our AIS plant faculty member, at that point we were able to pull out the drawings and, and use those, and just it's certainly a major draw, as it will be for visiting researchers and others as well. It's going to make an enormous difference.
Member Blackburn.
Thank you so much for coming here today and sharing this information. I have actually three questions. And the first one is really about that prioritization, thinking about Starry Stonewort, is that what it is called? Okay, and how that compares to Curlew Pondweed, which has been around for a very, very long time, and is a nuisance, but we've actually got a number of different management tools. And so when I think about prioritization, I'm like, Curlew Pondweed's a pain, but Starry Stonewort is really a threat that we don't know anything about. And so that prioritization of where you put the money is the first question. The second one was, I wasn't aware that heterospirosis was an aquatic invasive species, and I'm just curious about that. And then the third one is anything with rusty crayfish.
Mr. Chairman and Member Blackburn, so the way that we're addressing or tackling this challenge of having more things than we could possibly address is twofold. So we have a technical committee, and annually they review sort of our priority species list to see if there are new species that we hadn't appreciated were important. There's another crayfish that we should be even more worried about on our doorstep, for instance. Red swamp crayfish. The issue then is that still isn't really what research should we do. And so we undertook a research needs assessment and had some expert teams on various species groups address what are the biggest gaps in information and which are the most important gaps that need our attention to make the biggest difference. And we convened those groups in 2014, and we'll do that in alternate years, do a comprehensive assessment, and then in the other years we'll do sort of an update. And so based on that process and with oversight from our external advisory board, we identified about 20 research priorities that were widely considered to be the sort of the most important new things we could do. So what we don't want to do is, after we've made an investment in a project, we don't want to stop it to try something else. We need to, once we commit to it, as long as it's yielding interesting science and something that looks promising, we want to keep that going. The question is how should we expand our scope and agenda? So we use that research needs assessment to identify 20 more priorities. And then it's a matter of trying to figure out who can do the science. And so I guess it's a little like buying land, that you might have the willing, willing seller, right? In this case, too, we need to find the scientist who is interested and capable of doing effective research. And so to that end, we took our research needs list, created a competitive process, rebudgeted some of our funds, and put out an RFP to try to attract researchers interested in addressing the priorities. And now we're working with them, and we'll be bringing in and starting 3 new projects that are addressing those high priorities, and we will have sort of 2 new researchers at other institutions that will sort of build our capacity as well. So, the list is a little bit longer, and then we need to go out and find that group who can do that work. Does that address that question?
Yeah, thank you.
Let's see.
Heterosperus.
Heterosperus, yeah. That's a species that we need to understand much more about. It affects a fairly high percentage of our game fish in Minnesota. It's a muscle wasting disease. And the issue is basically how does it spread? What are the sort of factors that affect it, its incidence in lakes, and then certainly trying to model what are the effects on game fish populations to try to understand what are the impacts, so we'll know the extent to which it needs to be a priority for control. Thirdly, rusty crayfish. I don't have anything to offer on that today. It didn't rise quite to the level of some of the other needs in terms of prioritization this past year, but certainly it's one that we know stakeholders are working on, and we'll hope to be able to capitalize on some of those efforts as we set up our AIS trackers program.
Other questions or comments?
Chairman Anderson?
Yes, Ron.
I have a question.
Please go.
And I apologize if this has been answered before, a little difficult hearing, but I'm concerned about the priorities at the center. With this maybe example, we're spending a lot of money and making Minnesota boaters jump through a lot of hoops at the boat access ramps, etc. Yet, is it my understanding?
Member Scherer, we've lost you for a minute.
Okay.
Understand.
Now, can you hear me?
Yes.
My question is, we're making Minnesota's boaters jump through a lot of hoops to launch their boats, etc., but it's my understanding we still don't know how zebra mussels are transported in boats. It would seem to me that would be an obvious research project for the center. Is that taking place, or am I wrong here?
Mr. Chairman and Member Chair, we do have a research project that is looking at transport and boats and boat design. And so that project is launched recently. It's part of a broader effort to understand zebra mussel pathways, both from docks as well as from boats.
Did you get that, Member Sheriff?
Well, sort of, but thank you. I got enough of it to know that the center is looking at that. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions or comments?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Senator. Thank you. One other question. You talked about the external advisory board. Can you tell me who's on that and what authority do they have? Are they a recommendation or recommending only to you? Or, I mean, do they go through a list every year and say this is where we need to focus? And what kind of authority do they have to carry through that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilberton, our external advisory board was established under agreement at the time of the center's establishment and specified an external advisory board comprised primarily of representatives of various agencies as well as particular groups. And then there are a few at-large members. The board is advisory to the director, and basically the way that we've utilize the board is to do things like bring our research priority list from the scientists to the board, and with that additional management expertise on the external board, get their feedback and input. And as an example, our research needs assessment list changed a little. Basically, they endorsed most of the list, also requested a few things be elevated based on their understanding. And so they've definitely influenced the priorities and also direction as well. So, you know, when we're sort of thinking about for instance, how we will translate our research to the public, what that should look like, how we should be collaborating with other organizations that also are working with the public to understand AIS, we've been very much received a lot of important input from our advisory board. We meet quarterly, and so basically it's not a budget-setting board. It's not a decision-making board, but advisory.
So just give me an example. There are some rural members on there, like association people, that type of stuff, DNR folks, U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, not specific lake associations, but the membership is about 12, about 12. It includes members of, for instance, a local government unit, the DNR commissioner, a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service representative, and a representative from representing sport fishing groups, watershed districts, that covers... So we can get you a list of that. Not specific lake associations, but more broad groups of the state.
Thank you. And just a point of interest, you may want to consider that. They're getting bigger. They're getting more organized. And what a great way to get your message out of what's being done, what's accomplished. And lake associations are getting... would be a great way to get the message out. So you may want to consider that. That's all. Thanks.
Thank you. Further questions or comments? Thank you, Doctor, for being with us today and for sharing your information. We're a little behind on the timing on the agenda by our own doing, but I'd like to call for a 10-minute break here, and then we'll come back and continue on with the agenda.